Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. This episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet. You can listen when you are taking walks, you can listen while you are cooking, whenever you can. The best thing? Audible is offering AI Asia Pacific listeners two free audiobooks with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to the link shared in the podcast description and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure you subscribe to see the link. Then, download your free title and start listening. It's that easy. Looking for book recommendations? We highly recommend Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill. Ali is responsible for overall strategy and is the head of ethics at Koa Health, alongside establishing and maintaining strong partnerships and business model development. He has extensive experience in strategy and innovation across a range of sectors. Before joining Koa, he was Director of Strategy and Innovation at Guy's and St. Thomas's Charity, responsible for investing 100 million euros over 5 years in innovations across acute, primary, and integrated care, and biomedical research and digital health. He was a senior civil servant in the UK Department of Health, responsible for UK tobacco control policy, and wrote the government's first comprehensive childhood obesity strategy. Oliver was also a policy advisor in the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit under Tony Blair. He has an MA in politics, philosophy, and economics from Oxford University. With you now, our host for this podcast, Kelly Forbes.
Hi, Oliver, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
No, thanks for taking the time. I hear you have been very busy stepping into your new role, so it's good to have you here.
Pleasure. Yes, it has been a rather crazy time, but the spin out is now complete, which is great. So I've got time to think again, which is lovely. As a strategy director, you really want that time to be thinking about the future.
And have this type of conversations.
Exactly. This is the kind of type of conversation I'd like to have.
Yeah. So it's probably a good time to then get you started to share more about your work bringing practice into ethics and AI. So last time I was able to learn a lot from you. So for the benefit of people listening here, do you want to share more about everything that happens in your world?
Everything that happens in the world. Okay, well, here quite a long time if I do that. Well, I'll focus a bit on the ethics side of our work. So let me give a little bit of background, actually, for people listening in to the podcast. I'm the strategy director and head of ethics at Koa Health, which is a new company which focuses on mental health and brings technology to help people with their mental health. And our aim is that everyone can have access to great mental health care through technology. And as I mentioned before, we've actually just spun out. So we were part of the Telefonica group. So Telefonica is a massive global telecommunications company. And we were there for 4 years within their disruptive innovation team. And we've recently, just last month, we've spun out, we've become independent, we've got external investment from some VCs in Europe, and sort of entering this next phase of our growth, which is great. So we're commercializing our products in the UK and the US, and actually also in Southeast Asia. So we're coming to see you soon when we can travel again.
Looking forward to that.
Exactly. a big part of our work, and has been from the very inception of Alpha Health, Alcoa Health, is trust and ethics. And it was something that we recognized early on, because we work in health, and of course it's an area that's really deeply important and integrated into people's lives. And they don't feel the same way about health that they might feel about booking a holiday online or something. So we thought, well, if we're going to be successful, we're going to need to be trusted and be trustworthy in our products. And we spent some time thinking about what does that really mean? And during that time, so 2016, early 2017, it was in that kind of post US election, post Brexit, everyone was talking about Cambridge Analytica and data and trust had become much more of a pertinent issue in people's lives, and they were much more realizing what was going on. And people were also talking about the importance of taking an ethical approach, and that felt right to us. So we agreed that, well, actually what we need to do is think about what is being ethical for us, and let's build that into our work. And the way that we've done that is at three levels. So firstly, like many people, we have our own ethical principles. And there are a lot of ethical principles out there, as I know that you've seen. So the EU has its set, IEEE has its set, the UK, every government has a set of ethical principles. And we looked at a lot of those, and we drew from that, and we came up with five principles of our own, which was to support health and well-being, because of course that's our main goal, so to make sure that we're always doing that, to put the individual, to put the user in control, to be transparent and explainable, to treat people's data securely in a privacy-preserving way, and then finally to be accountable as well. So we had those five. And having done that, we then thought, well, what does it mean to put that into practice? Because that's where the magic really happens. Otherwise, it's just a piece of paper that web paper. So we've done a lot of, we continue to do a lot of work on this. Actually, this is the hard work, and
it's ongoing, right?
I was going to say we're not finished. We're not where I would like us to be. So that there's a lot more to do, but we have made some pretty good strides, I would say. So we've looked at design. That's quite a big part of how we think about taking our principles and putting them into practice. So maybe a couple of examples. So one is thinking about the consent process. Of course, that's really important for people to, when they're using one of our, so we have an application called Foundations, which is for stress and building resilience. And of course, when people on board in that, they have to approve and consent to the terms and conditions and the sharing of data. And we think quite a bit about, well, how can we actually structure that in a way that's meaningful? Because what we want to try and avoid is just the click everything when you click yes to everything when someone on board, which is sort of the classic pattern. And actually do something where you're building more understanding and more trust in the user. So we're experimenting with different methods of layering, really, is probably the best way of doing it. So I know you've talked to Nathan Kinch, who is...
Yes, who is the king of this, I would say.
I think that is the right phrase. Yeah, he is the king of this. He's evangelical about this.
Yeah.
He's fantastic and
for people that don't know, he's the founder of Greater Than Learning now, which is platform that encourages people to sort of bring these principles into practice, right?
Exactly. And he and I met end of 2017, and he was in Barcelona presenting about this stuff, and I was there. Sort of absorbing and listening, and then we just got talking, and then felt like we were quite like-minded in how we were thinking, and said, well, you've got to come and do some to work with us. And so he did, and that was in the days we used to travel. So he came over from Australia to Barcelona and spent some time working with the team, which helped us learn about the different ways we could approach this. He would absolutely say that the way that Foundations is at the moment is could be improved, and that's right. So we're still experimenting with how we can look at this layering. But one example of this that he's really good at and we think works is the kind of context dependent consent. So only really asking someone to consent to something when it's actually pertinent to them. So there's a feature that we're going to introduce soon, which is really actually measuring your kind of heart rate and your breathing rate, because that's related to stress. And rather than just assuming that, oh, well, of course, someone's read all the terms and conditions in the privacy policy and they'll remember that we want to look at that data. When they click on that on a feature that involves that, what will happen is that's the moment where they will be asked to consent to that data. So it's meaningful at the time for them. Oh, right. Okay. Right. So, but also what you can do then is have what Nathan and others will describe as the value exchange, because it's really clear that, oh, well, if you want this great feature that's going to help you with your stress, then you need to consent to this data, and you can learn a bit more about how we do that and what we do with the data. So that's one thing we think about a lot. The other side of the design is on bias, actually, because people often think about bias in terms of data, and that's true. That is really important. But there is also bias that exists in the language you can use, or the imagery that you can use in an application as well. And the design team here also spend a lot of time on that. And we work with another company called The Other Box, based in London, who helped us think a lot about that and helped us produce a kind of a checklist, really, if you like, and a bit of a guide for the design team to actually understand what were the biases that they may be subject to, like affinity bias. So sort of people you tend to kind of think about people in the same group as you, and how you can work to overcome them. So one example is in one of our treatment applications, an application called Mindset which is just about to be in beta, actually. This is cognitive behavioral therapy for depression. So the app is basically supporting the therapy. And in the language that we initially were using, we were talking about people as if they had jobs, effectively. So there was language that was used that would suggest, oh, when you're stressed at work, or when you come back from work, or whatever it may be. And we kind of looked at that and thought, well, actually, that's not going to be right for everyone. And what we wanted to avoid was the situation where we make someone feel inadvertently that this app isn't for them. Because, of course, if someone thinks, oh, well, this is for workers, or people who have a job already, and I'm a student or I'm unemployed at the moment, then they wouldn't perhaps use the app, and they wouldn't benefit from it in the same way. So it when we think about bias, certainly in design terms, we think, well, if it means that people aren't going to benefit from the application, then we're doing a bad job. And if we want people to have as many people as possible to have access to great mental health care, then that's not really fulfilling our mission and vision. Another aspect of building this into practice is at the technology layer as well. And I think a good example of this is some of the work that we've been doing with the National Health Service in England. And we've worked with a hospital in the Midlands called Birmingham and Solihull Mental Health Foundation Trust. And we've been working with them on predictive analytics. So the idea is, wouldn't it be great if you could look at data, in this case, the medical record data, and you could predict if someone was going to have a mental health crisis. Now, of course, if they're going to have a crisis, that's not great for them. No one wants to be in crisis. And of course, it's not great for the health system, because it's much more difficult to help someone once they've had a crisis, because it just takes longer, you have more intense needs. So if you can actually predict this and do something about it, then that's better for everyone. And the clinicians are really keen on this. And we work really closely with them to understand how they define crisis, how that could be shown in the record. But one thing was just absolutely clear from the outset. They said, you have to, this algorithm has to be explainable to us. If you are giving us predictions and you cannot say why the algorithm's come up with it, we won't use it. And it was just like a total red line. And fair enough, right? Because ultimately they're still the ones responsible. So the clinicians are still, they're still the people that are saying, we will see this person or we won't see this person. And if they don't see a person, then actually they do indeed have a crisis, then it's on them. It's not on the algorithm as a decision support tool. It's not making the decision itself. So that was really, really important for the research team, because all of their dreams of using deep learning on this huge data set were sort of thrown out the window. So you can't use that anymore because we can't explain that. We can't explain all of those types of algorithms. So they had to use different, types, and they also had to make sure that in terms of the way the information was being fed back to the clinicians, that we can explain it. And we can explain it in a way that's meaningful to the clinician as well. Because what we found, and there's some quite good papers on this at AI Ethics and Society earlier this year in New York, actually, where they, and I can't remember the paper, which is really bad of me, but there was a person who was describing that explainability, you can think of it at sort of layman's terms, where sort of you and I would go, oh, right, I sort of understand what that's doing. So it's kind of that level of explanation. Then there's explanation sort of at the level of the user, which in this case would be the clinician. So she or he could say, right, oh, I understand from a clinical context why it's chosen, why it's flagged this person. And then there's the sort of expert explainability, which is for another data scientist, effectively, and someone who could really go into
the very technical.
Exactly. And I think that we've certainly found that differentiation, those three levels, super helpful as we think about explainability and building explainability into the technology. Then the last level of the building it into our work is more, it's going to sound really boring, but it's the more process side. And although it does sound really boring, it's actually really important, because if it doesn't become a regular way that we do the work, if it's not part of how we actually get things done, then you're just you're never going to be really consistent, and we're not going to be delivering our ethical principles with high fidelity over time. This is our biggest challenge at the moment, actually. This is where it's hardest, and the challenge I find as head of ethics is that I don't want to impose a different way of working on a team that's already very used to sort of agile working and a very iterative approach. So I know that what I cannot do is say, okay, everyone, I just want you to take a month to really think about this, and only then can you start designing, or only then can you start coding, because I just know that won't work. What we were trying to do is actually do a much more iterative approach, where we say, okay, well, here are the, let's do some thinking up front about maybe some of the trade-offs that there are and some of the scenarios that there might be, and then use that to implement some design, and then maybe let's check that later on. And that's the work that we're trying to do at the moment, but I definitely don't have an answer right now. And I think we're going to work with some other organizations to help us with that. Because it feels like that's going to be the real secret. So that work's ongoing, really, all of the embedding work. And then the final part of our ethics strategy, having set the principles, trying to put it into practice, is then the accountability side. And this becomes really important, because it's very easy for an organization to talk about how great it is and say, well, we've done all this stuff, and kind of in a sense mark its own homework. And the approach that we've taken to get around that or to mitigate that is to actually have external audits. We use a company called Etikas Research and Consulting, which is also based here in Barcelona, and they did an audit on one of our prototypes last year. So this was the prototype that led to Foundations, actually, which is our stress application. And that was really, really helpful. And they're about to do another one. One of the helpful things about, just to give you an example of how that was helpful for us, was they looked at this prototype, which was called Remix, and it was about offering people advice on what they could do to improve their well-being. And it had a recommendation system at the heart of it, which was understanding what was going to be most popular and what was going to be right for you. It was sort of a popularity-based algorithm, not totally, but it was that kind of ilk. And we wanted to know, well, is this biased or not? And Etikas looked at it and very quickly came back and said, we don't know, and we'll never be able to say clearly, because you've not collected any data that would allow us to say whether it's biased or not, because you've done such a good job of focusing on privacy.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you've not collected gender, you've not collected any of those things. And yeah, it was one of those moments where that's really obvious now you've said that. And I could have thought of that before, but we didn't, because we were just so caught up with the importance of privacy. And of course, privacy is important, but then so is bias. And it was really clear that we just hadn't considered that trade-off up front.
Yeah.
Luckily, what they were able to do actually was look at indirect evidence of whether Remix was biased or not. And in the end, they said, well, we think that it's okay. There's not really any evidence to suggest that, you know, one group was suffering poor outcomes. One of the aspects that helped with that analysis actually was the use case the Remix had. So Remix was about well-being, and Etikas's view, which we agreed with, was the chances of an individual really suffering, so having bad outcomes from a well-being app, was actually quite low. Of course, I'm not saying that well-being app is of no use, but it was not really going to have if it suggested that you went out for a walk versus, you know, spend time with friends or whatever it might be, there wasn't a huge sort of detrimental outcome from that. But they said, look, if you'd done this with actually one of your treatment applications, so if you'd done this on a depression application, and we discovered that maybe it was biased and some groups were having worse outcomes on depression, actually that would be much more important. And that, in that circumstances, you need to work harder to actually understand if there were any bias and what the sources might be. So in those circumstances, you actually might need to actively collect directly information about bias. And that may mean, wouldn't necessarily mean that we'd have to collect personal data from everyone, because of course that then goes against privacy, but it could mean that we would, for a representative subset of users, we could say, okay, well, we want to collect this personal data from you for the purposes of understanding whether this application is biased, but only for that purpose, not for anything else. So that was really important. That auditing work just really made us recognize, wow, we do need to think about these kind of issues up front more, and kind of goes back to the point about processes and making sure that we build it into the processes. So we haven't made great strides in that yet. And actually, Etikas is coming back to audit us beginning of December on our live product. So they're going to audit Foundations, the stress product, and Mindset, the depression product. So we will see where we've improved and where we still need to do more. But that's the overview of what we do, you know, the principles, putting it into practice, and then the audit.
Wow. Okay. So I think that gives us a very good overview of just how difficult this process actually is in practice. So, you know, obviously our work is, you know, we work with organizations like yours that are trying to follow this process, and at the same time, you know, we work with, you know, the organizations that are sort of coming down with these standards on a more theoretical level, right? And what you realize is that this transition from theory to practice, it's very challenging, as you've been describing, and it's a lot of work. So yeah. There's so many questions now, but a good place to start is, so obviously we speak to organizations every day, you know, sometimes as small startups, it's very time consuming to go through this process. Not just time consuming, but, you know, smaller companies also have, you know, limited resource to educate to this process, right? And at the same time, you know, most of organizations would agree that it is important to build trust and invest in this area. There is going to be no escape from this. So in your experience now, going through this and seeing the organization, has this been worth it? And you know, what would you say for people going through this journey now?
It is worth it for us. And we see that every day. And we see that from when we talk to our users. And they don't, we don't say in any of our applications, we're trying to be ethical and all that. So, but we will say that you know, your trust is important to us, or your data is, we know your data is really important, and we treat it carefully. So we do talk to them about how we do these things, and it's clear from some of that kind of qualitative research that users do recognize and appreciate when we're trying to explain things more clearly. For instance, one of the approaches to explaining data that we've used is a kind of a visualization. So for sleep, we actually, rather than say we use this sensor, we actually kind of had a sort of a visual of someone in their bed, and then there's the kind of sensor here, and you know, the phone, we use the light sensor, we're using this, and it was just much easier for people to understand, and they really like, the users really liked that. But equally, we also get good feedback and appreciation from clients as well, and also potential clients when we're offering our services to them, and it's really great to kind of have that recognition, because they will, of course, in health they expect us to be looking at, you know, GDPR and HIPAA in the US, and those are a given. But then when we start talking about, well, here's what we're doing in ethics, and here's how we think about the use of data. So what we will say for foundations, for instance, is that we're just not going to share with you a detailed sort of person by person analysis of how your staff are stressed or not, because that will just undermine all the trust that we can build with your employees, and therefore they won't use the application, and therefore they won't benefit. So we'll only give you a very aggregated, non-personal report, and they really like that we think about that. So I for us, it's worth it, because it's just so aligned with the purpose of what we're trying to do. Because we will always say, if we're not trusted, people won't use it, and then they won't benefit, and then they won't be healthier, and then our company will fail. And I think what I would say to any other organization is make that link to your core, to your core work, your core value that you're trying to bring to users as a company, because there will be an aspect of that which is building trust, and then think about what does building trust in your product mean for your users, and then build your principles from there. And it does take a little bit of thinking. But at least what we found is if you ally it to your core purpose, it's not as hard as you might think otherwise. But I think one of the challenges people often face is, wow, there's all these documents, there's all these principles out there, which ones should I choose? And definitely do read some, you know, read the government where you are, read the principles there, read EU principles, whatever. But think about your context and think about your core value, and then say, okay, well, what are the most meaningful principles for us? Because then you'll find it much easier to articulate those for yourselves, And also, what we find is the team really love this stuff. And it's a big part of our culture. And quite often, the team will say, well, should we be doing it like this? Or what about this? And that's great, because I can be head of ethics and sit on top of all of this, but I'm not the person that's doing the coding or doing the design, and I can't be in every single meeting. It's crazy. So you have to rely on the culture of the team more than anything. I know I've talked quite a bit about the process, and that is important, but even that has to rest on a culture of people wanting to do this and feeling it's important. Because of course, if you impose a process in a culture where people don't want to do it, they will just find ways of getting around it or just paying lip service to it and it not being meaningful. So the process is there to help the culture flourish rather than to sort of squash it.
Exactly.
So I would say it's a practical purpose.
This has to start internally, right? It has to start with internal policies to get people to be on the same page before you actually start implementing these ideas.
Yes, it does. And I think it goes beyond that, in that not doing this or not thinking about it doesn't mean that you don't somehow have an ethical position, because you will implicitly. You just won't have thought about it. And I used to work in the UK government for a few years, and we used to say to ministers, not taking a decision is still taking a decision. And ethics is a bit like that. So just because you haven't thought about what your ethical position is doesn't mean you don't have one. You do have one. You will have a sense of whether your business thinks one thing is good and another thing is bad. But it's much better to think about that up front. So in a sense, you can't get away from this.
No, you can't. by default, you're already in the process. And I think you highlighted trust there a lot in the conversation. And I think, you know, it's been said, trust is the currency of the future, right? And there's no way around that.
Yeah, well, it's also the currency. And actually, a currency is fascinating, because currency is all about trust, because but most currencies these days are not backed by gold, and they used to be. And you could say, why is £10 worth £10? Because you could say, there's some gold backing it. But now £10 or $10, that piece of paper in your pocket is only worth $10 because everyone believes it's worth £10. And everyone trusts that it is, and that everyone else in the country and in the world will say, oh yeah, that's £10. And I can buy things with that. So trust is the canvas that we operate on without even really recognizing it. And it only really has become such an issue now, and we think about it more, is because the technology is allowing us to do things that we hadn't previously thought possible. And as a result of that, we sort of have to rethink, so this thing that is I can now use data to predict with much greater accuracy whether someone is going to have a crisis or not. Does that mean that the algorithm should make that decision on its own? Or does that mean a doctor should still be in the loop somehow? So all these questions that we never really had to answer before, we have to now build into our kind of societal values of what we think good and bad is. So kind of trust has always been there. It's just now become pertinent again, because we have to reconsider things that we kind of thought we'd solved, which is why that people, you do have an ethical standpoint. It's probably the kind of the one from the previous century where we didn't have, we didn't have all this technology, but you need to rethink, okay, now what does it mean for the 21st century now that I've got AI available?
Yes, yes. And so, well, you're sitting in Europe right now. I think, in a general question, I was going to ask, how do you think that compares to the rest of the world? And then it was just last week, I think there has been some new developments in Europe in terms of conversations around regulation and so on. So we know, I guess, Europe has been ahead of other regions in that sense, in terms of thinking more carefully about data, about technology and so on. So what is your, what's your thoughts around this?
Europe has definitely been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I think is probably ahead of the game from a regulatory perspective, and in terms of how it's considering going beyond GDPR and thinking about ethics more broadly, you know, beyond just data. In fact, GDPR itself isn't just about privacy. It also talks about explainability and, you know, and bias and other facets. But I think there is that there's a sense in Europe that, that we do need to go beyond GDPR and have something that's stronger, yeah, and really grounded in the human rights framework that's at the heart of European policy. I think the challenge for Europe is that what it wants to see is businesses coming out of this, and European-based businesses coming out of this, which is absolutely fair. That's a totally legitimate policy goal. But I think the regulation on its own is not going to do that. So the challenges that, that Europe has in terms of it still being a reasonably fragmented market or reasonably small markets to build into, not simply because of different regulations, because there's quite a lot of common regulation, but just, you know, the different languages that you have to think about if you're building a product in a European context, does tend to mean that a lot of European companies, and we are one of those, are actually looking to the US as the first market, just because it's a single market that you can, that is big, that you can grow into quickly. Well, if you have a good product, you can grow into quickly.
Yeah, you're saying it's large and it's uniform, right? It's what you expect.
Pretty much. I mean, it's there's some state level differences that you can find, particularly in health. But by and large, you're right. It's a single economy, and that's great to grow into. And Europe doesn't yet have that to the same degree. So what I think Europe will need to still do is be able to try to foster those kind of bigger European companies. Now, from a consumer perspective, actually, that may not really matter, because if Europe has this really good regulatory framework, then we can expect more ethical and trustworthy products within Europe, even if they're from the United States or they're from China or they're from, you know, wherever, to play in Europe, to be offered in Europe, they'll have to comply with this new framework. So from a consumer perspective, I think that we will see greater progress there. I think one of the opportunities that there is, I mean, there's great researchers and data scientists in all European countries. And one of the aspects of the regulation that I think is going to be really nice is that innovation loves constraint. So we will see more research into privacy preserving AI and explainable AI, and applying those to the more difficult AI methods. So deep learning is of course really, really powerful, but is probably the hardest one to explain. You can explain some neural networks, like a feed-forward neural network, you can explain, and Cohort Health done some work on that. But recurrent neural networks, we can't yet explain. And there's quite a few people looking at that. So I think that the regulation can provide this sort of constraining, innovating opportunity, but then we haven't quite got the final piece of the kind of single market puzzle to really let that grow into large scale companies. But as I said, kind of from a consumer perspective, that may not really matter.
Yeah, I quite like that angle, because that's going in favor of innovation. You know, a lot of people believe that regulation might in a way constrain innovation, and that seems to be the concern of most startups or, early founders around this type of technologies, when, you know, perhaps if we have that correctly shaped, we can actually dedicate more time to getting things right. Like you said, we do need to see more research. You know, sort of that process that you described there in the beginning, I think, you know, we do probably need to dive deeper there. We do need to, you know, give people better tools to, so they can do this themselves, right? Not every company have the funds to have, you know, a head of ethics or head of data right now to be able to do that for them.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Do you see the rest of the world, including where I am, Asia Pacific, sort of falling? And I am in Asia Pacific, not actually, but even though I've got the San Francisco background here. do you see the rest of the world sort of following those steps that Europe seemed to be taking?
I do. I think there will be some differences, of course, and that's as it should be. You can see in California, where it looks like you might be, is considering very strongly stronger data protection laws and ethics is a real part of that conversation. In Australia, where I know you actually are, there's also, I think, a lot of work going on,
yes,
on this theme as well. And it's, I think, from the limited knowledge I have on it, I think quite a bit of it has come from the banking sector. I think there were some problems,
right,
that I think there were some banks, and that's led to this kind of groundswell of demand. You know, more must be done, and I think that Australia is actually really doing a lot of work on there, and maybe Australia will be the point within Asia Pacific that's the kind of the focal point, and then it grows from there. I'm less familiar with the way it's being thought about in Singapore or in China and in other areas, but I know that these probably every country will end up looking at this. One of the interesting aspects of this, I think, is the degree to which the underlying principles are in some way universal or not. And IEEE, I think, was initially criticized in some of their early work on looking at ethical principles because it was very much Western philosophy based. And they have actually done quite a lot of work now looking at different sort of philosophical schools from Asia, from Africa, from others. I don't think they've quite got to the level where there's as much consideration of those other schools as the sort of the Western philosophical tradition that certainly I'm more familiar with. But I think it's going to be fantastic to see how a more, let's say, kind of Confucian philosophy fits into the ethics of AI. What I would anticipate is that the kind of issues that we will face, you know, bias and privacy, and addiction and autonomy, they will still be there. What I think we may see is that the way the trade-offs are made ends up being a bit different depending on what country you're in. And you're starting to see some of this in the way that different countries have used data for their kind of COVID-19 contact tracing, where certainly from what I read, and a kind of very kind of Western European perspective, is that in Taiwan, say, there is it's quite a strict system, and the way it gets played out, kind of in the UK and Spain and in the US, is that would never ever be put up with.
Yes.
But I'm not necessarily sure that's true, because what we're really doing is say, well, they're making a trade-off versus kind of individual versus community rights here, and there isn't a sort of hard and fast answer to that, and it can change in the context. And Taiwan might say, look, in the context of COVID-19, we think this is the appropriate response. We're not saying it's going to be the appropriate response always, but that's what we think is working for us now, and it does appear to be working in terms of caseload. So it's kind of hard to argue against. Whether it would be supported in Spain or UK, I honestly don't know. But I do think that some of these differences in ethical perspectives, sometimes they're kind of overblown. Although equally, I would say a lot of the times that they're also underappreciated. So I think we need to find a better equilibrium.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good point. And we do need to consider that there's a lot of history there. And end of the day, I think each government might take a different approach to how they deal with this. Because in reality is that they, you know, we're usually dealing with in a different culture. You know, there's a certain level of trust between population and government that changes, you know, and accordingly they have to do things that sort of reflect that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So out of everything you described there, going back to that process, consistency was a good one, I think. And that goes for, you know, the ongoing monitoring and that also, I think it's a concept that's moving away from that idea of, you know, just showing ethics or just talking about ethics, or it's simply having an internal policy there and you're done with it, or sharing that publicly, right? So it's sort of, you need to encourage organizations to move away from the ethics washing and actually incorporate that on the day-to-day, which is the most challenging part, really. How do you see that process if for organizations that are not prepared for it? So let's put it that way. At what stage do you think the organizations are ready to take that step? So, you know, I think that you lie there the foundations of having some type of internal conversation where, you know, everyone is in agreement about what you're doing, and then you're moving to implementation. And then perhaps later down the road is when you can talk more about consistency, or how does that play out?
I think you laid that out really nicely, actually. Yeah, I think there are the organizations that are doing this now are those that really care about it, but either because their leadership has just said that this is something that's really important to us and we will do it, and or because the companies recognize that actually for our value proposition, for our services, if we don't do this, it's not going to be successful with, and we're a bit of both of those in a sense. And those companies that those organizations that really want to do it, doesn't have to be private sector, are the ones that are doing some of the hard graft on, well, actually, how do we do this in practice? And we are trying to draw from the work of other organizations, you know, like Nathan's, like Greater Than X and Greater Than Learning, or, you know, like Etikas, like the other box, who are thinking about this and starting to provide some of those tools, you know, privacy by design, ethics by design. I don't think we have all of the toolbox there yet. And so I think that the companies that are working on it now have almost a duty, really, to publish what they're doing and talk about it and be honest about the mistakes and try and learn from others. And that's certainly something that we're really keen on doing as well. But I think it's going to be harder for those companies, but because it's such an important part of kind of their core beliefs, it feels like that's going to be okay for those organizations. Then I think we will see a wave of organizations following that they recognize it's important as well. But because some tools have been created, it's an easier lift for them to get into it. I think this is going to be really important for startups. I think what we need to see is that there's ethical canvases or ways of doing ethics by design that just make it really easy for a startup to build it into their agile process, and then we'll see those fast followers coming on. And eventually what I would expect to see is that almost the regulatory environment will catch up. And not exactly sure how this play out, but what I think might work, how it could play out is that there is a base level of quality that is required by any government for all organizations working, working in data in that jurisdiction. You might argue, for instance, that ethical audits, I think for me is something I can imagine governments insisting on and saying you have to have understood how you are using data and what your principles are and how you're making trade-offs and you need to audit that in the way that your accounts have to be audited as well. So that's a standard thing for businesses and organizations, that because there has to be a certain level playing field that we can trust what you say about your money, and we need to be able to trust what you say about your use of data. But then I think on top of that, I can imagine a more of a risk-based approach where, depending on the outcomes, bad and good, that might arise from some AI, there would be more regulation involved. And I would imagine this would happen in health. So for instance, I imagine that we'll have a system in health that will be a little bit like the regulatory system for pharmaceuticals, where if you are producing an application that is giving people advice on health and well-being, that has very light regulation. If you're producing an AI system that is the treatment, or it is making a diagnosis and it's not a doctor, then that has heavy, heavy regulation to ensure that it's accurate and it's yeah, consistently accurate for all different types of people, which feels entirely appropriate to me and to us. And so I think that we will say this, I think we will see this sort of level that everyone has to get to, and then a risk-based approach on top of it. And I think that will work.
Yeah, it just has to happen, right? But if that doesn't happen, now you're someone that's sitting on a, healthcare company there, and then you've seen firsthand what it's like to, do something and then, potentially getting it wrong, right? When we're talking about health, which is something quite important there for people. Are you personally concerned about what else is happening around the world, given that generally, most companies now have the potential to do things their way, not everyone is being taking steps like yourself.
I definitely have concerns that both that there will be bad outcomes for people, and say a bit more about that in a moment, but also that in having those bad outcomes, it will undermine the general population's trust and desire to actually benefit from new technologies. And there's a lot of benefit that can be had from these new technologies. Wouldn't it be great if we can predict people having a mental health crisis? That's a great thing to do, that we can then avoid that. Who doesn't want that? As long as it's done appropriately. I think the risk is that, not so much, I mean, we can talk about kind of singularities and all that sort of stuff, but kind of leaving that aside, because I think I personally think that's some way off, if ever. But I think the more immediate concern is that AI is like a mirror to humans. People fixate on the data as the problem, and I'm not saying that the data cannot be problematic sometimes, but the data set is usually chosen by a data scientist. What you're optimizing for is chosen by a data scientist and the organization. So it's really AI is very often just reflecting back our own biases and our own prejudices and problems that we have in our societies. But what, of course, the technology can do is amplify and scale that in a way that we've never really seen before. So what I'm worried about is almost what you see in social media, where there have always been people who've had opinions you disagree with or who've been prejudiced. And now we can see that prejudice kind of being scaled rapidly with an audience, and also sort of being... reinforced by almost actually by the business models of some of those products. So you can see there's this kind of amplification effect. What I wouldn't want to see is in health is that the biases that mean actually the least advantaged members of society fare even worse in health terms. And you saw this sort of recently in the US, where there was there's an algorithm that was being used to kind of allocate health resources to people on a health plan, and the data it was using was actually based on previous utilization of healthcare services. Because you would imagine that, well, if you've used a lot in the past, then you probably will need a lot in the future because you probably have a chronic disease or whatever it might be. So sort of on the face of it, that feels like, oh, that's fine, that's reasonable. But actually what happened was that it ended up being very, very biased against certainly African-Americans, I think maybe other groups as well, who themselves have suffered this historical lack of access to healthcare, which means that, well, of course, if you're not accessing healthcare, then you're not using it and you're not spending money. So all of that stuff wasn't showing up in the data, even though they absolutely had health need. And so my big fear is that we end up amplifying some of these problems and these biases and making things even worse in terms of health inequalities, whereas actually we should be using technology to just break down those health inequalities.
Yeah. So just to build on that and I guess close our conversation here, how do you see the next few years, I guess, in terms of, relationship, human and machine unfolding? You know, if we were to get it right, what would that look like?
What I hope it will look like is that we get to a situation where we don't notice the AI. And what I mean by that is it becomes a tool that we've managed to regulate and understand how to operate and have the right processes in place that we know that we can use data to analyze and improve products and to do predictions of crisis, to personalize treatment so that it's just as good for an African American versus another American. But it's not really noticed. It's just become, oh, this is a really good tool and this one's better than the other one. And I'd like almost to get to a situation where it's a bit like electricity. And because people say, oh yeah, it's great, it's going to be like electricity, but we don't have departments of electricity. We don't talk about, we don't have sort of electricity strategies these days. It's just, we need that because that enables everything else. But we have regulation on electricity to make sure that no one gets electrocuted if they stick their fingers in a socket or whatever it might be. And I'd really like us to get to a situation where, in a sense, it's just not talked about in the same way. We more talk about particular tools and what those tools can do, and do they comply with these regulations or not. But we don't sort of fixate on AI as a class. We actually end up just splitting it into the effectiveness of these health tools or the effectiveness of these energy efficiency tools. That's where I'd like us to get to.
Yeah, that's a really fantastic analogy. Well, we'll see. I guess we can look back at this conversation in 10 or 20 years and see if you get it right.
Hopefully, yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully I'll talk to you sooner than the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah. For people trying to reach out to you, what's the best way?
People can reach me at my work email, which is ollie.smith@coahealth.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn, although Oliver Smith is not the easiest name to search for, I admit, on LinkedIn. But if you look under Coa Health, I'll be there as well. But my work email address is a good one to use.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.